Hello and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Bader, a member of the club's Asia Pacific Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Peter Cowie is the Dean of the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UCSD, where he holds the Qualcomm Chair in Communications and Technology Policy. Dr. Cowie serves on the U.S.-China Experts Group on Innovation Policy, has advised the Obama administration on trade policy, and is also the former chief of the FCC's, the Federal Communication Commission's, International Bureau. He's the author of Transforming Global Information and Communication Markets, The Political Economy of Innovation, and numerous articles, including Unlocking the Benefits of Cloud Computing for Emerging Markets. It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Peter Cowie.
Good afternoon, and let me offer my thanks both to George and the Commonwealth Club for allowing me to be with you today. If I can start with just a brief national public radio moment, you know that NPR does not allow ads, but you always hear that little announcement at the beginning of every program. So I'm made available to you because the state of California has invested in building a major school of international relations with a special focus on the Pacific at UC San Diego, and I've been fortunate to be the dean of that school now starting my 14th year, which proves that the cost of replacing a dean is so high that nobody bothers. What I'd like to do today is talk with you not so much about exactly who's winning where in the Pacific or global area in digital technology competition. Instead, I want to talk about a transformation that's occurring in how we innovate, and therefore in how markets are going to operate and how competition will unfold, and that from there are a number of public policy challenges that we face as a global society that Asia Pacific will be very much at the center of figuring out. So the takeaways I hope that you'll come away from today after all the slides is, first of all, that innovation, in fact, is becoming even faster and cheaper than it was 15 years ago. And as a result, we are seeing the unfolding of new business models every time we open the newspaper. And more profoundly, that this wave of innovation is transforming industries that we never thought of as high-tech industries, so that, in effect, the information technology and production revolution is changing industries that we never thought of as fitting in that box that we used to call high tech. And from that come a set of disruptions that open the door to creative new policy options. And by saying that they open the door, I mean that people have practical interests to become advocates of public policy change, and that for reasons of seizing the best opportunities opened by this technological transformation, we really have to get on with the job. So with that as sort of an overview, let me start by trying to explain why I think there is a significant change in how we innovate. This is a picture of Lego's building blocks, and they're important for understanding this change because we are seeing three things intersect. The first is this, that the information value added of every type of product and service is increasing over time. Now, that simply means that as a result, you can't think of things as being, oh, this is a traditional manufactured good, over there is Uber. Think of it instead this way, that today you can go out into a hardware store in the Bay Area, and in a number of the stores, there is a kiosk that is fully automated where you can have household keys made. That kiosk makes those keys using a database that is smart with sensors that recognizes the key you drop in the bin, then operates lasers to cut the key precisely, and then charges you over an electronic payments network. No human beings involved. Can you think of anything more traditional than making a key for a household and thinking of it now as basically an information service that just happens to have a key as one piece of the chain of value? If you actually look at international trade globally, this is starting to change the composition of international trade in dramatic ways. We can't count and enumerate the economic value of services in international trade as accurately as we can widgets and automobiles. But to the best capacity that we have, we now estimate that over half the value of commerce crossing borders in the form of trade is in services, and those services are highly information dependent. So when you think about wheat or automobiles as the nature of international trade, just remember that's now the minority of what is occurring in the world economy. Now, why is this change of the growing information content and value of everything occurring? Well, the underlying driver, of course, has been Moore's Law, which, of course, originated here in the Bay Area as a rule of thumb about the cost performance of computation. And basically, Moore's Law has changed over time, but it says roughly that every 18 to 24 months, the power of computing doubles without the cost increasing. And when you take that over time as a log function, you come to realize how stunningly powerful that change is. So information is relatively cheap, but here's the complementary change that, again, didn't exist 15 years ago, which is wireless broadband data is everywhere, so the connectivity of information is available everywhere. And that changes what you can do with information. And the final element is that Legos building block. Slowly over time, both for reasons of technical efficiency, but also because of public policy decisions, particularly in the United States, information technology has become standardized at the point of the interfaces of one piece of technology to another. And that's what the Legos building block is all about. You can mix and match Legos blocks to build things in any variety of products or shapes or functions, but the interface is always the same. And so while the U.S. government does not require information technology companies to have some standard Legos building block interface for information technology, it is basically said that if you're powerful in the marketplace, you're IBM in the old days, Microsoft in the 90s, or Google today, and the way that your technology is available to hook up with other people's technologies is too obscure or too difficult, that is a competition issue that the U.S. government may act upon. And that, plus the technical advantages of standardized interfaces, has meant that it is possible now to mix and match information technology far faster and more cheaply than it could have been done in the 1990s. Now, those three things as building blocks intersect with the other big change, and that is a production revolution. And the thing to understand about the production revolution that you see in the pages of the Chronicle or the Wall Street Journal is that we're really in the beginnings of a production revolution. It's not here yet in full power and form. The image, of course, that is most easily seized upon for this is the 3D printer that everyone talks about. But the 3D printer is really the beginning of a whole series of ways in which robots, the specialized types of production that can be using essentially materials in a spray form to then customize and build pieces one at a time. And information technology are changing production. Now, I'll give you a couple of pictures in a moment. But if you start with a 3D printer, remember that it's not just making small objects. We now have elements of jet engines being built by General Electric being printed by 3D printers. All right? We're now talking about the fact that pieces of bridges crossing expanses of water are being printed by 3D printers. And the economics of 3D printers are partly about the fact that they use less labor, but it's also because they consolidate parts and raise reliability because there are fewer parts to piece together and weld together for a complex product. The next steps with 3D printers and the production revolution of robots is smart materials, and that's unfolding before our eyes. Materials that are emerging today are going to be networked in their core. So you aren't going to put on top of them something like a laser to go over and run across their top to see if they meet quality standards. They will have baked into them sensors that report if the material is reliable or decaying. So let me give you a couple of pictures here. This is the step beyond Fitbit. It's a brain tattoo. It literally goes on, can be put on the head, and it covers a wireless power coil, sensors, a battery, photo detectors, an antenna, and the rest. And it's like a Band-Aid. And it can be put there in some discrete place, let's say here, lower neck or something, under your hair, and monitor your brain functions if you're epileptic. All right? This is simply the beginning of the way in which flexible materials that are networked are going to open up whole new applications in the world and change a good deal of biomedical practice. This is sometimes in its early stage what's called wireless health technology. It's now being called part of precision medicine, which combines the power of computing, networking, flexible materials, and advanced biological interventions. Let me show you another example of the production revolution that isn't so straightforward, but again will help you understand about how extensive this is. This is a picture here in the Bay Area of a laboratory that tests chemical compounds for drug experiments. You will notice, if you can see this picture carefully, that there are no human beings in this laboratory. Bench science of testing of compounds and the recording of the tests is disappearing because this is essentially a set of robots working in a very sophisticated software system, control system, that measures out the compounds, drops them in, watches the results, records the results, and thus the reliability and the ability to replicate individual batch experiments is improved, while the cost and speed of the system drops, which makes drug experimentation change in its economics. There are still plenty of scientists in the system, but they're not at this stage in the system anymore, which was often where you found errors and costs piling up. This is a tractor in an American field. And if you look at that tractor, you will see that it looks like a computerized cockpit, and it is. It looks like a plane cockpit. And the reason is that agriculture is undergoing a revolution. It's undergoing a revolution because, and now I'm not describing tomorrow, these are products you can go into in Iowa and buy today. You equip your tractor with these information devices. The tractor itself is networked to a satellite. The tractor pulls a special device that actually does the planting of the seeds based upon the measurements of soil moisture and acidity and other factors that are being recorded by the sensors in the tractor bay and sent up to the satellite for real-time analysis to help suggest what the ideal placement of the seeds are at what depth. And then if you do this in a package from Monsanto, for example, you can buy from Monsanto crop insurance that will insure against certain types of crop failures if you follow the instructions. Monsanto, in order to do that, is now in the business of climate prediction at the level of individual farm fields. And thus, Monsanto is now describing itself as a big data company that happens to sell seeds. All right? That's what I mean about industries that you would have never thought of as being information intensive, starting to do very novel things. Now, here's the other interesting thing. As a result of this type of growth of activity, in places like Des Moines today, there are now new technology clusters in the business of analyzing farm data and exporting the expertise that they're building to companies and countries around the world, thus creating a whole new set of service industries in agriculture. Now, you can't read this slide very well from the back, so I'm going to try to explain its logic. And just bear with me for a second. Down here are individual countries, and the columns represent two things. One is this represents the role of information and communications technology investment in gross domestic product growth, economic growth in these countries, compared to all other forms of investment. So what you're seeing here is a visualization of what share of growth in gross domestic product, basic GDP, is the result of information and communications technology. The countries listed here are basically the wealthier countries of the world. And what you will see is that the dark blue is information and communications technology. The light blue is everything else. Now, what you should realize is that that dark blue investment in information and communications technology is only a small fraction in dollars of the total investment in the economy, yet it's driving, in most countries, anywhere from half to much more than half of total economic growth. So what we have is a relatively small wedge of the economy actually driving most of the economic growth. Now, over here in the bad handwriting that terrifies my students when I use it and whiteboards, you'll see the graph for Australia. And Australia is a perfect example of a traditional economy that is rich, because you see there the light blue line is a much larger driver of economic growth than that dark blue technology investment line. And why is that? Because in the period that is measured here, from 2000 to 2012, China is going through its economic boom, and it's driving up the prices for all the raw materials and agricultural commodities being sold on the world market, and Australia is selling into China. And so it goes through an economic boom due to those very traditional commodity markets. But for most everybody else in wealthy countries, growth comes predominantly from investments in technology. Not exclusively, but predominantly. Now, here's another way of thinking about the transformation that we're facing. This is a slide of worldwide, that's not it, that's information technology spending. And let me first tell you that you should never believe these forecasts, because everybody is dealing with imperfect data. But this forecast is probably pretty much in the median of the better forecasters and market analysts' estimations. And the thing I want you to see here is something that we actually don't understand a lot about information technology when you hear about it in the world. And the thing that you first of all think about in information technology is the idea of an iPhone or your tablet computer, right? You think of devices. So that's the number up here. And in 2014, the world spent about $700 billion on information technology devices of all types. But I want you to notice that that's actually the small part of the market. Here are traditional telecommunication services, the ability to make phone calls, your basic internet connectivity, and that was over $1.6 trillion in scale and volume. Here's the thing that is important to know. Services like telecommunication services have been much bigger and more important for information technology than devices for a long time. And now what is occurring is that information services of all types, which are enumerated here, are becoming as big or bigger than traditional communication services. Now go back to what I said at the earlier part of this talk, that over half of world trade is in services. So what we're seeing now is that traditional communication services have dominated information technology. They're now being outstripped by information services, and information services are the key to the growth of trade and services around the world. So the picture that we have to have in our head is of a world where everything is networked, everything is becoming smarter rapidly in surprising and unorthodox ways, and even the way that we make things is changing because the production system is getting smarter and more aware of its environment through system sensors. So I do all that background so that you can get a sense of the tidal wave. I've just returned from a week-long meeting of experts around the Pacific in Tokyo, where every country in the Pacific region is taking a look at these numbers and going, how do we deal with the question of growth or the management of the economy if the nature of the economy is changing so rapidly in front of our eyes? This is our common problem and challenge. All right? Now, sometimes when we get to this challenge, it instead becomes reframed in terms of national competitiveness and who has what advantages. And certainly, what we just saw in the visit of the President of China to the United States was a moment of friction underneath the efforts to be cordial and work together on a number of fronts. And that was a friction created because many American information and communications technology companies, and I should add their counterparts from Japan and Korea and Europe, are extremely nervous about the treatment by the Chinese government of their companies. And you will commonly hear the senior leaders of these companies say, not so much on camera, but behind closed doors, you know, we think that we are being discriminated against in China and that we are in very dangerous terrain, but China is the fastest growth market in the world in information technology, so you have to be there. So we're stuck with it, even though we're nervous about it. So that's a very common notion. But what I want you to realize is that while those frictions are true, there are two things that are also true. One is that we all share this common dilemma of this transforming economy changing rapidly before our eyes, whether you're in China or India or Japan or the United States. And secondly, that the traditional wealthy countries of the world, the democracies that are wealthy around the world, still control a vast share of the world market in these technologies. These numbers basically tell you a story for information and communications technology markets around the world. The United States remains by far the largest single market in the world as a national market, 27%. Europe's at about 21%. China, for all of its growth, is at 11%, and Japan's at nearly 8%. The rest of the world constitutes about a third of the remaining revenues. So, in fact, there is enormous market power still residing inside of wealthy democracies who have an interest in finding enlightened public policies to govern this changing world economy. And to me, when we talk about leadership in the world, we are facing a moment like the mid-1990s once again. And what do I mean by that? In the early 1990s to mid-1990s, the United States recognized that the internet was going to be a really big thing. In fact, I was in the Clinton administration at that time. We couldn't tell you exactly what that meant in detail, right? That was just the case of you had to place your market bets and make your best guess. But we knew it was going to be big. And we knew it was going to break the boxes that we had the economy organized around. E-commerce, of course, was one of the first outgrowths of this, right? And so we led in a way that was very important in setting an example for the world about how do you start governing the economy to deal with this fundamental new fact. One of the things we did with e-commerce was pretty simple. We said, to a significant degree, we're going to exempt these new e-commerce firms from many of the traditional regulations at the state and local level for retail sales. And the reason we're going to do that is not because we know what in the long term should be the exact equities about taxation of Amazon versus, you know, Macy's. It's that this is something new and fundamental, and we should watch to see how it grows, what it's doing, and then figure out exactly how to govern it once we have a better idea of what it is. We made a whole series of decisions like that, which in aggregate opened up a huge era of innovation and growth in productivity and growth in employment in the United States and around the world. That was a moment of taking a time of change, placing some bets, and trying to really be imaginative about how to take advantage for the future of our societies. And what I'm suggesting to you today is that we face a next moment of those choices, and it is still within the grasp of traditional democracies to strongly shape the guidelines, the premises of this revolution. And that is our collective leadership challenge, not ignoring the role of the many important emerging economies, but recognizing that we have a long tradition of democracy, rule of law, and insight into dealing with economic transitions in technologically intense ways. Now, I'm not going to bore you with some of the choices we're going to have to make in any detail, but I want to, again, give you an example or two of the types of questions we're going to be asking ourselves. And what I want you to understand about these questions is that information is changing how we define businesses and what businesses do in very, very fundamental ways in front of our eyes. Here's one that you're all aware of, which is your cars are networked and they are going to be yielding data about how you drive, potentially. So Progressive Insurance now says that if you'll install a vehicle monitoring device in your car and you're a Progressive Insurance client, they will reward you with major discounts for good driving conduct, which they can monitor because your car will tell them what you're doing, right? Now, here's another one to think about, and it's about defining market boundaries. What is a company about? It turns out that there are a number of studies suggesting that your likes on your Facebook page constitute better predictors of whether you smoke and use certain types of drugs than any other way we have of predicting personal behavior. Now, it's not because they study you in great depth. It's they study patterns of behavior tied to the indicators of Facebook likes to determine these things. So it means that Facebook, which knows its data better than anybody else in the world, arguably has a competitive advantage in setting an insurance market for certain types of insurance risks. So should Facebook be an insurance company? Right? Well, that's no more ridiculous than thinking about the fact that the person who owns a Honda Accord that picked me up last night is now in the personal limousine business, right? All because of GPS and Uber connections. All right? So markets are being redefined in front of us, and they're being redefined because information is changing what we know and what we can predict about people and how we can coordinate people at low cost. So here's the last example I want you to think about before I get to a closing policy example. And this is about manufacturing. So I'm old enough that I remember the revolution in just-in-time production and delivery of goods around the world. The growth of computer networking and services like FedEx and UPS Overnight allowed us to set up global production chains which were much more finely tuned and disaggregated than we had ever imagined in life. It caused a fundamental reorganization of how companies worked and produced around the world and about how you as consumers are served. That was a really big deal. Now I want you to think about the next revolution for parts of the world market. Not every part, because not everything is going to look like this, but for some parts, which is you order a manufactured good. You want a customized piece of furniture. Instead of it going to an order to be shipped, let's say, over to Hong Kong for placement inside of Shenzhen for production in Shenzhen and then coming back across the ocean, now that order is essentially no longer shipped out. Instead, it's put into the next fifth generation of 3D printers, and it's provided. Or to give you a more dramatic example, and this is occurring today, starting to occur, a Boeing Dreamliner is flying across the Pacific Ocean. Its network sensors indicate that there is a maintenance light coming on saying you should be replacing a particular part in this aircraft when it lands in Tokyo. You're not in any crisis, but this is should be swapped out at the next stop. So instead of a part being shipped to Tokyo, it's printed in Tokyo. So a good becomes a service transmitted electronically to a printer across national boundaries. Manufacturing no longer is for certain parts of manufacturing the movement of goods. It's the movement of information to printers. And that's trade and commerce. Those sorts of things don't fit easily within the way that we've organized the rules and roles of global commerce today. Now, let me then turn to a last point. And I want to just give you a thought experiment. A lot of what I've described to you is based on the role of information. It's information about what makes cars more reliable. It's observations of the production system. It's observations of air pollution in society. It's observations of your personal health and behavior. You aren't going to go for checkups in the same way that you used to with physicians. You're going to have real-time monitoring of yourself, especially as you get older. All that means that there is going to be vast amounts of information, some of it just machines, monitoring machines about routine systems, which nobody has a problem with. But a lot of it is going to be about you. And thus we have the sensitivity about privacy that has become a renewed subject for discussion in public policy. And if this vision of the world economy is right, more and more of that information is going to be embodied in part of the feedback in the design and the operation of business models around the world in every conceivable industry. And the question that you want to be posing to yourself is, so in a global economy where production and supply and demand and people are all moving globally in incredible ways, what is the protection for privacy that you expect? And how do you deal with the fact that countries have different standards of privacy and trade-offs? Here's an example to think about for the United States versus Europe, for example, two sets of traditional democracies. In the United States, we have the First Amendment, the right of speech. And that right of speech changes how we treat privacy as opposed to Europe, which has no such constitutional guarantee. In the United States, a court raised dealing with privacy claims always has to say, does privacy interfere with speech, the right to speak? In Europe, those protections of speech are not as strong. So there are very, very deep reasons why privacy standards differ around the world, and yet that information about you is going to matter more and more for how the world economy operates. And so the challenge that we face, that we're going to have to get ahead of, is how do we get an approach to privacy that isn't uniform around the world, because countries are going to differ. Constitutions differ. National values differ. But how do we know that there is something that you can say, just like with public health, that pretty much wherever you go, there are going to be certain capabilities and protections built into the system? And while you have different public health risks in different countries when you travel, you more or less know that there's a baseline that's there, and that that baseline provides pretty good protection and provides you, you know, with some confidence about how the world operates. How are we going to do that without cutting off this enormous wave of creativity and innovation that will eventually raise wealth and benefits for consumers around the world? One way of doing that, and this is the last point I'll make, is by thinking about being creative in public policy around the world. And this is going to be a hard, hard job. This slide starts to think about that problem, and I don't want to go into details, but here's the thought, that we already know in international economic agreements how to set certain types of requirements for what governments have to do to provide certain minimum capabilities and protections. World Health Organization sets rules about what constitute minimum public health surveillance systems, so we know if an epidemic is breaking out, for example. In trade, we have rules that say you must have certain types of regulatory protections and markets built in to make sure competition is more or less viable and robust. We're not telling you exactly what the rules have to be, but you have to achieve a certain level of minimum capacity to regulate in a responsible way. And we have rules that say things like you have to make decisions about regulations in a transparent way so that people who are from the outside can understand what you're doing on the inside. We have those precedents, and it turns out that they could allow us to start thinking of how to create a much more robust set of minimum protections for privacy around the world while allowing for a lot of room for innovation and experimentation and differences in national tastes and priorities. But the point I really want to make about privacy is this, that there's going to be a whole series of things that come with a change in how we innovate in the world that are going to test our traditional rules for governing the world economy. And those choices are choices that we can either stumble into blindly, or we can take a moment and say, something big is happening. Let's try to get our heads around it, not because we can come up with a perfect plan, but because we can know we're at a moment where we have to really think about this creatively and cooperatively. So I ask you, when you hear the presidential debates now unfolding in the United States, and they all say, you know, typically candidates, America should lead, what are they telling you to lead about? They're telling you to lead about the fact that the world economy is changing around us, that somehow we have to find common ground about finding the ground rules of this changing economy? Or are they telling you, you know, we've got to be better than the others, or others are being unfair? And all those things are legitimate worries. You know, are people playing fairly according to the rules of the game? But there's a larger challenge in front of us, and it's a challenge that is going to face every country and their societies in the world. And it so happens that the Asia-Pacific region will be the center of innovation, and therefore these problems are going to come to the fore really strongly out in the Pacific first. Thanks very much.
This is Beth, not Marianne. I wanted to ask if you could go a little bit deeper on how this framework applies to Asia as a whole. You touched on China, but, you know, Asia is so diverse, Southeast Asia, sure. India, Korea, just curious.
Right. So the economic forces I'm talking about and the technological forces are going to touch every country. You know, we're seeing a very striking phenomenon across Asia, which is the growth of many different innovation clusters specialized to regions across Asia. So these forces may take place at a different pace according to the country. You know, the Indonesian communications and information infrastructure is nowhere near as advanced as the infrastructure of, let's say, Singapore, right? But nonetheless, these forces are taking place. And it's affecting how trade is going to be organized. And for these economies, trade is crucial. A rough rule of thumb to try to give you some perspective on how the world economy works is that the United States has about 25 to 30% of its economy tied to world trade and investment. So about 70% of our economy is kind of self-sufficient, untouched by world currents, but 25 to 30% is. For very, very large numbers of countries, the number is 50 to 100% equivalent of the value of the economy is tied up with global commerce in some form or other. So that if you're in the commodity business in Indonesia, for example, and it's a big commodity exporter, the revolution in the way that we're going to monitor and run the supply chains for agricultural goods and raw materials is going to be very profound, and Indonesian ports are figuring out how they're going to fit within it. Meanwhile, if you're in Thailand, there are huge numbers of new applications for managing Bangkok traffic, thinking about air pollution management in Thailand and the rest, which are all part of this innovation economy. So while there'll be places that are bigger players than others, India, Korea, Japan, China being the ones that spring, you know, most to mind, everybody is going to be touched by the transformation and the basic dynamics.
Hi, I'm Bill Bonin. I'm a software guy. I wonder if you could talk about the TPP. And how that will fit into this framework.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't remember the acronym, TPP is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has stirred, you know, a fair amount of political turmoil in the United States. but which will probably be brought to a conclusion as a negotiation this fall. And that negotiation covers essentially North America, Canada, the United States, Mexico, a handful of countries in South America like Colombia, and then a significant number of countries in Asia, but not China or India, for example, or Indonesia. And that negotiation has been controversial on a number of points, but it has within it some beginning points for trying to sort out this challenge. They're beginning steps. So here's one that you would think you would want in the world economy I'm describing, which is to take advantage of these technologies. You want information to flow freely across national borders so that you can take care of everything from financial transactions that require parties across borders through the management of supply chains, through monitoring of public health and epidemics around the world. But the flavor of the day in a lot of economies is to start restricting the flow of information across borders in the name of privacy and security. The idea is that if you have it inside of your country, it's less subject to abuse by foreigners. There are only a handful of problems with this. The first is that for many of the basic flows in the world economy, which your economy as a country is dependent on, you need to have data flowing back and forth around the world. The second thing is that with the arrangement of how we manage, and I'm sure you're expert in this, how we manage the actual computer networks of the world today, we rely on very large data centers to help make them more efficient and economic, and you want redundancy. You want backup of information across regions, in a sense, so that the system doesn't crash. I don't know if you've read about when airlines have been grounded in the United States because their computer networks are crashed. Well, that's an example of insufficient redundancy in the computer networks, which is something in the long term in a network society you do not want. Imagine if we discovered that we have cars networked to drive autonomously and the networks crash. That is a bad idea, right? So we're building deeply redundant networks, and redundancy implies redundancy not just in having multiple places but scattered around the world and capabilities. So you want to have data flowing across borders, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership will make that easier to maintain. Not perfectly so, but substantially. Another thing the Trans-Pacific Partnership will do for the information industry is reduce some of the absurdities that we have today. For example, in some cases, countries have agreed to import DVDs, but they won't allow Netflix. Well, they're both providing media across borders, right? But the answer is that a DVD is one thing and a service is another, and so they're treated differently. In the world I'm talking about, you don't want those sorts of differences. So TPP is an important first step, but it's far from a final step. And one of the things it's going to run across in its implementation is how do we reconcile free flow of information across countries with protections of privacy and security. It's going to be one of our really fundamental challenges the next 20 years.
Hi, I'm Sansar. My question is more about, like, a lot of the governments in Southeast Asia and Asia have heavily influenced their IT sector, especially net neutrality. Mm-hmm. So do you think their change in the thought of net neutrality is going to be very gradual, or do you expect a fundamental shift, a radical shift in the government policies?
Well, you're going to see a lot of variation around net neutrality. For those of you, this can become hopelessly technical, net neutrality. So here's the basic idea of net neutrality is that you don't want the people who control the underlying communications infrastructure to be able to discriminate among the providers of services over that communications infrastructure. So in practical terms, if you want to think about it in your everyday life, if you're reliant on either Comcast or AT&T to deliver your basic internet service to your home, you don't want AT&T or Comcast to be able to say, our subsidiaries that provide you with movies on demand or provide you with weather services are going to get better treatment in how they're delivered and served by our network than those of competitors from Netflix or from Google or whoever else. Okay, is that basic concept pretty clear? And so the net neutrality idea is that there are certain fundamental non-discrimination rules that should be enforced by governments to make sure that the people who control the communications infrastructure don't abuse their control of the communications infrastructure. I actually think that part of the story in its broad notion is fairly straightforward, and you're going to see fairly straightforward uniform approaches across countries. Where things get more complicated and where things really get to the point that it's hard to sort out what you're talking about if you're an innocent bystander is an argument like if you want to be sure that as a physician at home, you can access super high resolution images from, let's say, an MRI medical test of your patients while you're sitting at home, which requires a lot of extra bandwidth, very high quality bandwidth, should you be able to be charged more by the communications carrier for providing that? And those sorts of things become much more complicated arguments. There are also big arguments about how one communications carrier will deal with another. But my basic notion, point is, non-discrimination rules, I think we're going to be in fairly good shape about. The fights are going to be about the more esoteric parts of net neutrality. Yeah.
Good evening. My name is Veronique. There is a big debate going on in Europe currently about this technology transformation and the job creation versus the job destruction in comparison with previous technology transformation. And there is a position that this technology transformation will destroy more jobs than it will create. So I'd like to have your view there. And will Asia, for example, benefit more than other part of the world? What's your view there?
Right. So this is a very complicated question because, one, there are limits to what we know, and, B, there are several pieces to sorting out who wins and who loses in employment. In general, you would expect that Asia will do better with these transformations simply because, remember, I showed you how information technology drove growth. And for Asia, a large part of the growth of the future is still in the early stage of economic transformation. You're moving people out of the countryside into an urban economy with modern technology, services, and infrastructure. And so for them, these types of changes are likely to work well because they just simply have an earlier stage of economic change that they're investing in for raising productivity and wealth. For more mature economies like Europe or the United States, the picture is much more complicated. And there's, to be honest, a major debate going on among economists about the employment effects. So one image you have is robots are going to replace everybody. Remember that picture of the lab with no human beings? Another picture is that, you know, we go through these technological transformations on a regular basis in societies in the last several hundred years, and you invent whole new occupations you didn't dream of that didn't exist previously. My son, for example, is a knowledge curator at one of the big artificial intelligence research institutes in the world. And what's a knowledge curator? It's a person who's really smart about how to organize knowledge in whole new ways so that you can think about how it could work with artificial intelligence. Job didn't exist 10 years ago, okay? So now, to get to the heart of the matter, though, my guess, and this is by no means a scientific prediction, it's a hunch, that those forces I was describing to you of all these ways in which information is allowing us to innovate in wholly surprising ways, and production systems are changing, is that we're going to head to the beginnings of a new type of craft economy in the world economy, where a lot of things that were mass production goods and services are going to become boutique specialized goods and services with much higher skill levels involved. You know, one of the things I always find interesting in truly wealthy areas like the Bay Area or San Diego is the rise of farmers markets, which are absolutely paying a premium for boutique supply to meet very specialized tastes. Doesn't mean that they're bad. I go to them myself. It just means, though, that it is a different type of economic proposition. And I think that's going to happen with a large part of production in the world, that it is going to become far more customized. And if you think about the world that way, then there are lots of possibilities for positive growth employment. But it will mean different skill sets. And it's really retooling the labor force skill sets that are going to be an issue. And the other thing we're going to have to deal with, and Europe is actually better than the United States on this, is having a social safety net for when you have to change your skill sets, which are going to happen more rapidly in employment in a lifetime basis in the future. It almost follows automatically from the picture I'm talking about. And so I think the labor markets will look different. We'll have to have different types of social employment policies to sort of help buffer the labor market. And that the risk for Europe, frankly, is that they're so attempting to avoid problems that I can't think of a single major cutting edge in information technology that Europe is on the lead of. And that is a problem for a sophisticated economic region. I think that Europe needs to really think hard about what its policy set is doing to that edge of innovation in Europe.
We've come to the point in our program where we have time for one more question.
Okay. Heather Hudson, it's good to see you.
Yes,
again.
Heather. How are you?
I was just thinking as you were talking that about Asia-Pacific trade issues and European trade and information flows, that the issues that we seem to be confronting in the short term, or at least now with Europe, have to do with privacy in particular. But the ones that we are seeing and might likely see more of in the short term in the Asia-Pacific arena are security and intellectual property, which you kind of just hinted at in your DVD versus Netflix. But, right. You know, all of those can be addressed sort of through some of the approaches that you've outlined. But I wondered if you had any other thoughts about the Asia-Pacific arena in those fields.
Well, you're exactly right. You can't deal with the privacy issue without dealing with the security issue as well. You need some minimum standards of security to make privacy rights more realistic. And you need a way of saying that the security aspects of security that have to do with government monitoring are reconciled with our expectations of civil liberties. And so these issues are really going to become much more central to the trade arena and international economic commerce than they've been treated in the past. Normally we used to think of civil liberties, security decisions, sit over in the security apparatus and in national courts for civil liberty protections. And now we're talking about the need to think about them in relationship to managing the world economy. And that's a very different challenge. We're not well organized for it. I want to give you a picture, if I can. There's a reason why I put this in the back here. This is a picture of stolen credit card information. And it is an image of the fact that you can go online in the black web to essentially buy any number of types of credit cards you want, fitting any description you want, and have a chance to have those numbers available to you to see if you can buy stuff illegally with them or whether they're protected. And these go up in auctions so that you can specify, I want Japanese credit cards for people, for women between 25 and 35. And you can buy them on these online markets. You can also, in these online markets, buy the hacking tools to hack into the credit card companies. And it's all available for you to piece together online. So we are seeing a well-developed underground economy on a global basis that poses issues for security for you as consumers. And there's no doubt that part of what we're going to see as part of global commerce rules in the future are the guarantees about security that are going to go along with it. And that, again, does not fit within our traditional boxes of how we organize governing the world economy. It's going to be a big challenge for us in the future.
Our thanks to Dr. Peter Cowie, the Dean of the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of San Diego, or University of California at San Diego. Thank you for your comments today, Peter, and we also thank our audience here as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is now adjourned.